Good evening, and welcome to the regularly scheduled August 23rd meeting of the San Luis Coastal Unified Board of Trustees. The board met previously in closed session. We conferred with our labor negotiators and discussed two items of anticipated litigation. It was discussion only, and no action was taken. Do we have consensus on the order of business? Okay, I see that we do. We have two sets of minutes to approve. First, the minutes of July 12th, 2016. We have a motion by Mr. Questenberry, second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. Secondly, approval of the minutes of July 14th, 2016.
I have a correction that I had advised Mrs. Holmes about. I was not present at that meeting. I'm listed as having been present.
Okay, so I have a. Are you willing to amend your motion to? Okay, so we have a motion, a corrected motion, presented by Mr. Questenberry, seconded by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Abstain.
Okay, and we have. Let's see, how many of us are there? One, two, three, four. We have five ayes and one abstention.
No, two abstentions, four ayes, two abstentions.
Oh, you abstained. Okay, so we have two abstentions. We have one board member absent, Dr. Eisengrath Rogers, and we have four board members that are approvals. Okay. Wow. Okay. Item 5.01 is student representatives to the board. We have Caroline. Could you turn your name tag just a wee bit? Pettyholm? Okay. Caroline Pettyholm from San Luis Obispo High School is with us this evening. Caroline? Yes, please.
Hello, I'm Caroline Pettyholm, and I'm the ASP president for SLO High. So we have had a really great first week so far. I know it's only Tuesday, but it's been a success so far. Yesterday, on the first day, we had a lot of the ASB members and Link crew members greeting students at the White Gate coming in and on campus. And we had a lot of music playing, kind of getting into the mood of school starting back, trying to get into the mood of school starting back. But what Link Crew is, we had ASB and Link Crew, and so what the Link Crew does is it's a organization kind of formed by, it was started by the ASB and then another teacher kind of took a hold of it and kind of ran with it, which was awesome. So Ms. Badal was the head of that, and so what we did was at the beginning of the school year, we had people from various grades, all of upperclassmen mainly, and we had groups of people who welcome in new students. And so the week before school started, we had plenty of people coming in, and it was a great activity and kind of like icebreakers, and we did a scavenger hunt, which was kind of like a school tour in the same way for all of incoming freshmen and a lot of the new students as well. So that was a great success. Link Crew did super, super well. So for the rest of the week, we're having a bunch of lunchtime activities, kind of just getting people, again, back into the swing of things for school. Let's see. All of our sports are up and back in action. We're getting ready for a lot of the games coming up. Volleyball's coming up. Football's coming in tough. So hopefully we do really good this season. And, yeah, that's pretty much it for the week right now. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there any questions from the board? Okay, seeing none, we thank you for coming and joining us. You'll find that We announce that you're always welcome to stay. We, you know, we love student participation. We're also mindful that you have other commitments. So you may feel free to leave, and thank you so much for your time here.
Thank you.
The next item is 5.02 Summer Programs 2016, which addresses LCAP Focus Area 4. Mrs. Shields.
Good evening, Mrs. McGrath, and I will be sharing some highlights from the elementary and secondary programs offered this summer. We'll begin with elementary. We hosted summer school programs at four of our elementary schools this summer. There we go. With students representing all nine of our K-5 or K-6 elementary schools, with a lot of help from our transportation department as well as food services. We had a total of 393 students attend our summer programs. Daily lunches were served to our students as well as daily transportation. Of those students, 253 or 65% are learning English as their second language, and 303 or 70% of our students enrolled this summer come from economically disadvantaged households. Research has proven time and time again that summer reading slide is real, and students need to be immersed in learning activities to avoid the consequences of an unengaged summer brain. Specific studies demonstrate summer reading programs can significantly improve students' reading achievement if they're given access, choice, and support. With that in mind, our focus for summer 2016 was to provide fun and engaging learning environments where students would beat the odds of the summer reading loss. Our students were provided with an abundance of daily experiences to grow as readers. They read to themselves. They read with their teacher. They read in reading workshop. They read with their buddies. They read in comfy chairs in special reading areas. And no, this is not a Dr. Seuss book. They read for an audience. They read on Chromebooks. And they wrote about what they were reading in writing workshop. By the end of the program, our students had read a lot of books. This graph shows the breakdown of the types of books that they read. Here you see students posting their individual reading totals out at Baywood with a grand total for our four schools of 12,276 books read in just 20 morning sessions. In addition to reading and writing, students participated in daily math activities using our Bridges program and online individualized interventions. Individual classroom teachers added their own touches to make summer learning fun and engaging. Third graders participated in an integrated science and writing unit. Students in a fourth grade class were posed with the problem of choosing a location and designing the 23rd mission for California in a project-based learning unit. A special feature this summer was the Children's Farmers Market. The food bank provided fresh grown fruits and vegetables in a farmers market-like display. Fifth and sixth grade students, let me let you see that one, there we go, worked as vendors and sold the produce to younger students with pretend dollars. Students were able to select fruits and vegetables to take home to their families while practicing math skills and learning about supply and demand. It was a beautiful learning experience for all. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mrs. McGrath.
In the middle school, we tried something a little more innovative and exciting this year. So there were 3 2-week sessions that took place with about 40 to 60 students enrolled in each session. We did have a combination of upcoming 6th, 7th, and 8th graders and a really energetic staff that was really engaged and connected to students and had some really neat hands-on field trip experiences that you will see examples of here. Here's a neat quote shared from a Loam's parent that I thought I would share with you as well. You can see that our focus was to keep kids engaged in basic skills, just like Mrs. Shields said, but to do so in a more innovative way that would grab kids' attention and hold them excited about attending during summer school. In high school, we, due to Measure D, held both of the high school sessions at the middle schools. So you can see that we served 343 students. They were enrolled in 525 classes. Almost 2,500 credits were earned during the summer. So big success there. We did have a combination of, you know, kind of traditional brick and mortar classes, we called them. Six were funded by Cuesta College, which is a good opportunity for us. We also used APEX as an online opportunity for students to take courses. This was our first time trying this. APEX is the system that I talked to you about last year that is A to G aligned online courses. So we tried that during summer school, which really gave us the opportunity to offer some classes that otherwise we would have had too low of an enrollment to offer it. Also for students that weren't physically able to attend each day, maybe they had a camp for 4 days right in the middle of it, or they had a vacation plan for a long weekend or something. This gave an opportunity for students to come at the beginning, then they could kind of prove that they would stay on track with it, and then they had a little more flexibility that they didn't have to physically be at the summer school session for the entire summer school period. They could do some of that in other online opportunities.
So one of the things that I've read about is credit recovery in larger school districts like Los Angeles Unified, and concerns that the online courses aren't as rigorous as the brick and mortar courses. What do we do to assure the rigor and accountability in the classes to make sure the kids are actually getting what they need to get and being prepared for the college experience using the online course?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll tell you a few steps that we've taken. One is we had a pretty rigorous selection process before we chose this one. And part of our selection was looking at classes that had A to G approval. That A to G approval right there assures a lot of rigor, right? So they have to submit their courses through the UCCSU system and have those courses approved. So that right there is a pretty solid assurance. What we also did is reviewed some of the courses ourselves, went through, looked at how they compared, made sure they were Common Core aligned, and made sure that it was an instructional focus that was more aligned to what we were doing. So we did a lot of review up front. APEX is the one that we selected that we felt like first was rigorous and had an alignment to where we were instructionally and with our curriculum. In addition to that, as teachers were offering it throughout the year, we were asking for their feedback. And Don Addis did a great job of really helping us maneuver through evaluating those courses as we used them throughout the year for credit recovery. I think we definitely found that the rigor is definitely there. Also, another really neat aspect is when a student enters the course for a credit recovery purpose, they're able to have a diagnostic assessment at the beginning that then will take the topics that they need to cover, give them instruction, quizzes, tests, etc. on topics that they need to cover. And if it's in credit recovery course, it will also eliminate some of the topics that they can already demonstrate mastery around. So it's for a high school student that's sometimes behind on credits, that's very motivating as well. The Slow High classes, just a little summary here. We had 186 brick and mortar type of classes with 930 credits, and you can see the variety of classes offered there. The online courses, where 67 were completed, you can see the amount of credits there, and some with some overlap to the brick and mortar class, but some that were outside of what we were able to offer in the traditional manner. For Morro Bay, you can see 231 with over 1,000 credits earned. So that's great for those students. Really opens up some opportunities for them throughout the year, as well as the online courses completed there as well. At Pack Beach, they did have 8 courses, 8 complete, and 16 credits earned. So that sums up our summer experience. Any questions for myself or Mrs. Shields?
Yeah, I don't see any board questions, so it sounds like it was a very successful summer experience for our students, and thank you very much for the presentation,
Mrs. Shields and Mrs. McGrath.
Okay, moving on then, we have a video, 5.03, a video, a peek inside our SLCUSD classrooms. This addresses LCAP Focus Area 5.
Absolutely. I'm excited to show this quick little video. This was a video that we shared with at our new Teacher Academy, and it was produced by Jennifer O'Hagan, so I will give her lots of credit for this. But it's just a really neat little window into two teachers within our district. You'll find an elementary example as well as a high school example. And this, to me, is an innovative picture of what you will see happening. I always think it's, of course, not what everyone's doing, and that is the art of teaching that that we always want to value, but it is neat to see how some of our practices in LCAP Focus 5 has come into play in this quick video. So, hope you enjoy.
Hi, my name is Amy Burris, and I'm a math teacher at Morrobey High School. Here in San Luis Coastal Unified School District, we really focus on innovation and preparing our students to be 21st century learners. As 21st century learners, our students have different needs than learners of the past. In my classroom, we use Google Classroom in order to deploy the different activities that we're going to do each day for our students. So when students come into my classroom, they immediately go and get their Chromebooks from the Chromebook cart, and they log on and join Google Classroom. From there, they each have their own copy of a Google slideshow. In that Google slideshow, it gives them a variety of activities that they're going to complete throughout the day. This allows them to work at their own pace throughout each day and allows that differentiation. We have added to each of the problems some interactive online tutorials and some graphing activities through Desmos. In addition, we have videos to help them that might address some previously important information that they might need to be reminded about to successfully solve the problem. As they work through this day's activity, my job is not to be the teacher in the front of the classroom deploying information to the students, but a facilitator who's working around with small groups, focusing on what each student needs in order to move to the next level. So as we're looking at this, I'm able to have small conversations with groups of three or four students. With three or four students, students are more inclined to pay attention to the teacher when you're having a small conversation. As opposed to when a teacher's in the front of the class, we sometimes have students who might not be 100% focused. So this is why using the cloud and Google Classroom has really benefited each of my students and made Morrobey High School and San Luis Coastal Unified School District a great place for students to learn.
My name's Lena. This is my math class. This is Burris.
Well, usually we come in and we grab our Chromebooks and we log on, and the teacher will give us a general idea of what we're going to do that day. And lately, especially, we've been taking notes in the beginning of class to help guide us. And then she lets us work in our smaller groups and work with each other. It helps if you get the answer wrong, that you can, instead of just looking at the answer sheet and just filling it out, that you can talk with somebody and you can talk about it and figure out what you did wrong. Right now, I'm on a slide. We have slides that we go and work on, and right now I'm on one that's on a video, and this video is going to tell me how to do a problem, and it will walk me through it, and I'll be able to know how to go through stuff that's going to come up in the slides. Often with our slides, we'll have Desmos linked to it. This is a website that helps us graph and do things on the computer, graph the equations that we're given. Here you're able to type in your equation and it'll show up on here and give you an accurate answer. And you're able to add tables and folders and all sorts of things.
My name is David Curran. I am a third grade teacher here at Baywood Elementary. I think teaching is one of the most fabulous jobs anyone could ever have, because you're walking into the day with these just very complex thinkers, these kids that are so unique, able to do so much more than you could ever imagine. Every day is different, and it's just such a wonder and an amazement to be in an environment like that. I think it's absolutely essential for a classroom teacher to provide their students with the ability to be curious and the ability to use their imagination just to wonder. And one of my favorite things is to just provide these kids with open-ended tasks that have hundreds of possibilities, where there could be dozens of outcomes for one single problem, and everyone's different, but they've all arrived to a solution that is similar and that works. I think to continue to foster curiosity and imagination, we want to allow and provide students challenging material that lets them work through their questions and confusion. We want them not to be isolated in their confusion, so that's where collaboration really comes in. We want them to have time in the day where they struggle together, where they're not given the answer or given the solution to something, but where they're creating possibilities for a solution, where they're having to use communication, where they're having to use teamwork, and they're having to use analyzing of each other's work to really come and arrive at a solution together. I want to provide lessons where my kids are able to, be on a shared Google Doc, where all of them are able to share their thoughts at once, respond to others' thoughts, tweak others' ideas, and be able to take feedback and be able to respond to that well. I also want them to be able to learn how to comment well on each other's work. I think it's one thing to understand how someone learns and understand how someone maybe arrived at an answer, but I want my students to be responding to other students' thoughts. I want them to be asking questions, taking it a step further, and really having the kids in here be each other's teachers. So if you were to walk in my classroom in the morning, you'd be seeing some students over in a quiet group silently reading. You might see a couple other students underneath their desks, just the illumination, the glow of the computer screen on their faces as they work through the process of code and computer programming. You might also see a group of students over around this kind of duct-taped maze on the ground, where they're actually programming and using block coding to write a program for a robot that has to navigate through these certain sequences. You'll be seeing kids working with 3D design, both on their own and also trying to create something together. You'll be seeing kids on the same document but different computers, where they're collaborating on a shared assignment. They might be on the other side of the room from each other, but they're talking to each other through the Google comments, or they're working on a slide and creating a report together. I think it's really important for them to be collaborating, not only verbally, but also teaching them those skills to be able to talk online as well as communicate in many different forms. So it's crazy to think that we are teaching students and we are working with learners who are going to be in jobs that don't even exist right now. And so working in an environment like this right now gets me really, really excited, because we're working with the unknown. We're working with kids that are going to be reaching farther than we could ever have imagined. I think just being able to take advantage of the work they can do together is really going to empower them in the world they step into.
So big thanks to Ms. Burris and Mr. Curran for allowing us a little window into their classroom. So any questions?
Mr. Buckman.
Does that robot actually...
Can that vacuum while it's...
Slightly different feature.
Well, I don't see any additional questions. That was a great presentation. It was a wonderful way to start off the new year, because it certainly gave me the feeling of possibility and growth and excitement. I think we probably all got that from seeing it. So thank you so much for sharing that
with
us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, moving on, we have public correspondence, of which there was a considerable amount since the last meeting. We have two letters from the County Office of Education, both dated June 20th, regarding their review of our CSEA and SEIU bargaining proposals. City of Morro Bay email dated 7/11/16 regarding their resolution in support of revenue neutral carbon fee and dividend program. and which was also approved by the SLO City Council. Letters regarding the Morro Bay High School swimming pool project and the desire for community use showers. We have one from June French and others, Kathy Gardner and others, Debbie Highfill and others, Valerie Leviolette, and Dave Stevens, all dated 625 or 626. And I believe that is the correspondence that was received since our last meeting. Now it's time for public comment. I don't think that Mrs. Sheffer has received any written requests for comment, but is there anyone who did not fill out a written request but would like to address the board? Okay, seeing no one, then we'll move on to our superintendent's updates, item 7.01, business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, a few things to report tonight. Since we've been gone through summer break, of course, the governor has approved the budget, the state. Not much changed from the May revise in terms of, you know, impacts for us with the state budget. So we are going to receive some one-time funds this year. It is interesting to note, since that time, the state, it seems like, where we were seeing a lot of a huge influx of extra money coming into the state coffers through taxes, personal income tax, those types of things, that has kind of leveled off. And so in the last quarter, it actually, they had a little bit of a decline over their projections. And so it'll be interesting to watch that and see what the impact is going to be over the course of the year in terms of the state budget and how that proceeds. Kudos to Julie Lang and her staff. Of course, you know, summertime is closing up the books, pulling everything together, checking all of our numbers, you know, getting those unaudited actuals together, and that'll be coming to the board very soon in September. And so everything looks as expected as we kind of predicted through the budget system, so the budget review period, and so it looks great. I want to send a couple other kudos out to our food service department, Aaron Primer, who our new food service director, a lot of great ideas, has done a great job of actually took a class in our community to kind of connect with some folks in terms of gardening and bringing in fresh fruits and vegetables, and so has really kind of taken some good steps, I think, that we'll see some of those play out in what we're able to offer our kids in the future. You know, with the first week of school, transportation is normally just extremely hectic, crazy lines. And what I would tell you is that, are there a few issues? Yeah, there's a couple. But the days of 100 people being at the BG&T site to pay their fees, and it's all online now, and it's just been such a smooth transition for Annie and all of her drivers. And so, you know, again, all those things that we don't necessarily see sometimes that really affect kids and getting to school and having a great day, kudos to all of our classified folks for making those things happen. Lastly, again, I would say the tech team. Tech team has been crucial in terms of getting us prepared for our new phone system coming on board, getting everything up to date, all of our new buildings at Slo High and throughout the campus. So really doing a lot of planning and connecting with our community have done a great job.
Okay, thank you very much. Is there any board comment? Mrs. Sheffer?
So our bus routes are all right. Or will there need to be adjusting? And what's the longest a student is on a bus?
So I couldn't tell you that off the top of my head. I can find out and give the board some updates. But all the bus rides and all the routes are online, you know, in terms of for you to see. There's always going to be a little bit of change once school starts in terms of, but overall we really haven't changed the routes themselves over the past 3 years. You know, when we had our budget cuts before, we had cut the high school routes, we had reduced all those things. So since then, we brought back a lot of those spots, a lot of those, you know, in terms of the bus. The toughest part, I would say, is our special education routes. Those are the ones that change the most. Those are the ones that, you know, because a lot of door-to-door drop-off, and so getting students, you know, especially like if there's a special day class at Monarch Grove, and there's kids there from Morro Bay and Los Osos and Slo, you know, San Luis Obispo City. So there are some longer routes, and they do their best in terms of trying to cut them down as much as possible, especially for those students that really don't, you know, can't handle being on the bus for that long.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, anyone else? Okay, I don't see any additional comment. Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton. Moving on, educational services update, Mr. Robinette.
Thank you. Well, as you know, school started yesterday, and it's been a privilege to work at the district office for, you know, the last, I don't know, dozen plus years, and to be able to spend time out at the sites on the first day of school. And I always try to pick a place where I can be on what I call kindergarten duty that first day, so I can hand Kleenexes out to the parents and just stand at the door waiting for the runners, because invariably there will be one, I know it sounds sexist, but one boy who will look around and say, I don't think I belong here, and dart, and I'm right there to help grab them. Didn't have any of that yesterday, but I, from all intents and purposes, I know a lot of us were out and visited, I think, virtually all the school sites. Things seemed very smooth. The public will be getting our assessment results from state assessments likely tomorrow, where they're set to go public, I think, at 9 a.m. So what we will do is... so that you get the stuff the same time as the Tribune gets the stuff, we'll try to send out something that kind of gives you a sense of our state testing results in English language arts and mathematics. And the preliminary view is we did very well, and it looks very good for us. But we'll get that stuff out to the board in a separate email at the same time the public gets it, so you're not left guessing. During this first couple of weeks of school, we spend a lot of time on kind of tracking enrollments to see if we have bubbles of students or issues where we need to increase staffing at schools or decrease staffing at schools. And we're right about where we projected. I projected some growth for the district. We're a little under the growth, but we have grown. We've grown about 65 students year over year, which is a little less than I expected, which is good news for a community-funded district to have less students as opposed to more. Our class sizes are great. So K-6 is sitting at 25.6:1. That's an average of all kindergarten through sixth graders, so that's outstanding. And our growth is happening, you know, somewhat statistically and anecdotally in the city for the most part, and our declines are happening on the coast. And this is an interesting phenomenon. It's the same as what occurred last year, that the city is starting to grow a little bit, and the community, especially of Los Osos and Morro Bay, is starting to just not have as many kids in schools. So we'll see what happens with that trend. And it's since it is the opening of school, it is back-to-school season. So I know you all have schedules, and we can occupy your nights beginning this week and all of next week and into the week after that if you want to be visiting sites. So if you didn't get it, we'll probably maybe publish it again, because most of our back-to-school nights, I think, occur next week. We have some occurring this week and the following, but certainly welcome as board members to be at the schools and see us kick things off. And that's what I have.
Mr. Quesenberry.
Well, this is a tangential comment. About the opening of school, the second generation of students from my family has begun their journey through San Luis Coastal. Christopher Michael Jules showed up at Del Mar yesterday for his TK experience.
There you go.
And we're very excited about it.
Outstanding.
Okay, well, I also have a what did Jim call it? A tangential. I ran into a former teacher of ours, now retired, who lives across the street from Baywood Elementary School, Pam Alford, and on the day that school started. And she said that the kids were back to school, and I asked her how that was, and she said they all seem really happy and excited. So that was the view of the playground from Mrs. Alford's house, and we're off to a wonderful new year. Okay, moving on. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Buckman, was your light on?
Briefly.
I'm sorry, please.
No, okay.
Okay. Measure D update. I think that will be you, Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so in terms of Measure D, you know, Mr. Holcomb, myself, have been working with DWKR attorneys on the design build process, the RFP, RFQ, so we're kind of at the ending point of that in terms of having some interviews with firms to kick in those projects. But in the meantime, our design bid build projects have been going, you know, crazily, I would say, over the summer. You know, our first real summer of boots on the ground, you know, everything hitting, you know, a bomb went off at Slow High, right, in terms of all the, not literally, but all the projects, the annex coming down, new buildings, temporary housing on site. And so, you know, overall, I would say super successful with everything. Kudos to Anthony and his team. There's still some projects that we're completing, still finishing up. So at San Luis Obispo High School, the restroom and cafeteria. So that's coming in. Hopefully that's going to be, you know, open on Monday for students to use. Right now, they're making do, dealing with it as best as possible. And so, again, thank you to the food service ladies and gentlemen and the staff and the kids for, you know, helping us through these bumpy kind of patches as we get through. And then at C.L. Smith, the TK classroom is in place, but there's still some work to do around that building. In terms of getting that completely finished, so that's the other one that's close. And then the Monarch Grove sewer line is something that, due to some of our bidding that happened and came in way too high, we had to go back out and rebid it. And so, you know, just a few projects that we're still finishing up, still going to, you know, get completed on it. But overall, I think when the board, at the next board meeting, we're going to go through all of the summer projects, give you an update, kind of where it's at. I think you'll be amazed at what we were able to accomplish as a district in 2 months. I mean, it's pretty dramatic, and actually really excited. You know, the two model classrooms, you know, when I see the video of the kids and technology and all the things they're doing, isn't it going to be great to have a classroom that meets those same needs in terms of instruction? So I'm very excited about testing the products in the two model classrooms at Soul High and kind of moving forward. And so, again, I would say it was Leslie O'Connor had some T-shirts made, Stay Calm and Measure D on, right? So, these campuses are going to transform over the next 5 to 7 years completely. It's going to be absolutely fantastic and beautiful when we're done. But it's going to be tough going through the road. So, you know, for the staff and the kids and the parents and everyone to be patient, to work with us, it will pay off in the end. So I'll end it with, we have some tonight, some completion change orders, but at our next board study session, we will be reviewing the entire change order process, as we discussed back in June, and how that will work so the board understands the process. And then we'll also be kind of giving you a rundown on all the kind of change orders, issues that we've, contracts that have occurred over the course of this summer.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. With Measure D, not unlike my kitchen, we expect wonderful results, but sometimes it's gnarly getting there. Okay. The next item is a public hearing, 8.01, the biennial review of our conflict of interest code, and that will be presented by Mrs. Holmes.
We bring this to you every couple of years as required by law. You're required to review the code, and several years ago you had the foresight to adopt the FPPC regulation, so our code is evolving according to that regulation, and we don't have to worry about it much. The significant factor is the appendix, which just lists the people in our district who have to make those filings. And what we are proposing is that we modify that appendix this year to add the people who were appointed to the Measure D Citizens Bond Oversight Committee. They came on board since our last review of the code. So we'd like for you to hold a public hearing tonight on that proposed change to the appendix, and then at the next, we'll let that sit for 30 days, bring the revision to you for action at the subsequent meeting there, and then those are forwarded to the Board of Supervisors. they have to actually approve any changes you make to your code. And once they take that action, those changes take effect 30 days following their adoption.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Millar.
Kim, did the members of the Measure D committee, were they aware that they were going to need to file these statements?
Yeah, they did file them initially when they were appointed to the committee. Yeah. But they're not on our list of regular filers, and this will formalize that.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure that, you know, because they're not very onerous, but just it might have been a little bit of a surprise for folks. That's good to hear.
Any additional comment? Seeing none?
Yes.
Oh. Okay, I am opening the public hearing on the biennial review of the Conflict of Interest Code. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to speak to this? Seeing no one, then I will close the public hearing and we'll move on. Item 8.02, proposed developer fee increase. And that will be presented by Mr. Pinkerton.
So yeah, actually every 2 years the state revises the amount that school districts can charge in terms of developer fees, and so we had our developer fee study updated by Julie Avnet, went through a process where we put it in the newspaper, you go out, you let the public know about the potential increase, and so tonight this first item on the agenda is to have a public hearing regarding that increase.
Okay, then I will open the public hearing on the proposed developer fee increase. Is there anyone who wishes to speak to this item? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing and we will move on to the next item, 9.01, 1-16-17. Developer fees rate increase. Again, Mr. Pinkerton.
Yeah, so it actually came out in January of 16, and in talking to both Anthony and Julie Avnet, our goal is to really get this on a every two-year cycle that when it comes out, we bring it forward to the board, move forward. We actually missed a little bit of the window in terms of you have to have the 30-day notice before you can have the public hearing and bring it forward to the board, and with only one meeting in June, we ended up having to do that over the course of the summer, and so presenting that tonight. So should the board approve the increase in the developer fee, basically what happens is once that's filed, 60 days after that is when the fee would be enacted. And so it's a modest increase in both the residential as well as the commercial rates.
Mr. Millar.
I will move adoption of resolution number 01-16-17, developer fees rate increase.
I'll second.
So I have a motion by Mr. Millar and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. A roll call vote, Mrs. Holmes.
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mr. Quessenberry?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Passes 6-0 with one absence.
Moving on, we have item 10.01 to adopt the board priorities for 2016-2017. Dr. Prater.
Good evening, board and Madam President. It's been a few months since we've met, and it's good to be back. One of the things that we'd like to do when we start our school year is formalize it with the adoption of our board priorities. And what most people may not realize is that the Board of Education sets direction for the district. In addition to board policy, in addition to fiscal management, they really set the stage for a success story that needs to be told. We know also that that every school site has its own set of plans, its own goals, and as you move up, the district office tries to oversee those. But as a former teacher and a former principal, what I realize is that nothing is more frustrating than teaching in a classroom or running a school and not understanding what the school district or the Board of Education expects. So by adopting board priorities, we hope to create a better understanding of what the goals of the district are that aligns with the school sites. And what this does is this works both upwards and downwards. So the way that I envision it working upwards is that as a teacher or a principal or a parent at a school looking towards the district office and at the Board of Education, it should make sense what they're expecting the schools and the teachers and the principals to do. Should make sense. In other words, it should be coherent. It should be in alignment. And then when you look downward, you know, the board should also see evidence that what it is they're expecting is happening on the floor of the classroom. So in order to create that, we have to communicate upward and downward. What has helped with that, 6 years ago, the board adopted strategic initiatives. Those initiatives preceded the local control accountability plan, which recently came out in the state of California, and it preceded the Common Core state standards. So we've been very busy working to unify all of those efforts, both federal, state, and local efforts, to capture the voice of our community, to really align with best practices that we know our initiatives created, and hopefully simplify it. These board priorities recognize that, and I think capture the essence of what we are expecting to take place at our school. So we broadly characterize them as embrace. In other words, student achievement for all means all. Innovate, improving instruction. So what are we doing? You saw evidence in that video earlier of what it is we're trying to do to improve instruction throughout the district for our students. And then finally, a very challenging but most important element is governing our resources properly to reinforce those other two things. So embrace, innovate, and govern. Specifically, the first two under embrace, the first two priorities, first one is the LCAP, the Local Control Accountability Plan, for which there are six focus areas. Every single one of our school plans, our single school plans for student achievement, embody those things. Focus areas of mathematics, English language arts, English learners and literacy, STEAM and CTE, culture of care, technology and innovation, and data-rich culture. Each of those elements are embodied in what our principals and our teachers are doing within their site goals. And then, how does the Board of Education know if the students within each of their schools are actually achieving? Well, we're going to report and learn about whether or not our kids are learning. And so that's going to be a focus on our student achievement results. As Mr. Robinette mentioned earlier, one of the measures will come out tomorrow, which are the CASP results or the new state testing. And so we hope to share those with the board more formally in September. And but as you can see, achievement is a very important focus of the board. Innovate. We believe that focusing on first-time instructional practice is the critical element of great of student achievement. And so we know great teaching matters. That's where our focus belongs. That's what we're doing. And in addition to that, the board has expressed concern, and validly so, regarding the idea of access to technology. If we're offering it in our schools, if we're offering access to our students at school with the internet, with devices, how do we know that all students have access to those things if our expectation is that technology goes home and some have it, some do not? So we're going to examine that this year. And then finally, govern. There are three elements. One is, I'll talk about it at the next agenda item, is the transition the district through the news that Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant will close. This is a most significant event for us as a school district to manage and to address. And so that's number one on govern. Number two, management and implementation, successful implementation of the Measure D facility projects. managing taxpayer resources, doing what we promised we would do is an important responsibility, and that's why it's a priority. $177 million of taxpayer-approved bond monies will be coming into our district, and we intend to do that with seriousness, with caution, with respect to our taxpayers. That's why it's number two on the board priorities. And then finally, number three is really about long-range planning. Given the fact that we have these focus areas, these things that we want to do, and the world is changing so rapidly, and we know the transition through the Diablo Canyon closure will impact our ability to provide resources across the broad district. That's why it's number three, is programmatic alignment. How are we going to prioritize and make sure that our kids remain in great learning environments, our students have equal opportunities regardless of what school they attend and what grade level they attend. And that's why number three is important, that we have our eyes on it. So those are the goals, those are the priorities that the board reviewed this summer in their workshop. It aligns to the LCAP, which was in a reflection of broad outreach among students, staff, community. And so what you have here are the board priorities in draft form that were looked at and reviewed by the board in July, and I'm asking tonight for you to formally adopt them so we can then move forward.
Thank you. Is there any board comment? Mr. Buckman.
Yeah, just, Eric, while you were talking, it dawns on me, you were talking about the LCAP and how that influences our budget, and then we're talking about releasing the test scores, and they're just going to be released, maybe tomorrow?
Yeah.
And this is months after we've built our budget, which should be based on the results of testing and student achievement. So I just find that a little incongruous. But, yeah, I'd love to make a motion, Marilyn, to approve this.
I'm reminded that I should go to the public before accepting your motion, so just a moment. Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to this item? Seeing no one, then we'll bring it back. Mr. Buckman, you wanted to make a motion?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion, please, to accept the board priorities for 2016-2017.
I'll second that.
Okay, so I have a motion by Mr. Buckman, second by Mr. Quessenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? That passes 6-0. And then the next item, 10.02, Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant Closure Impact Report Number 1. Dr. Prater.
Excuse me. This is an item that will be coming before the board regularly throughout this school year. More specifically, each board meeting, we will agendize a topic called the impact of the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant Closure, and we will itemize the reports each meeting we go. And the reason for that is that this is a significant event. And I want to ensure that the public has plenty of opportunity to weigh in, and they have, thank you, and that they have an opportunity to hear the facts and express their concerns and provide feedback along the way. So what I have done to date, what our staff has done to date, is that we've identified what we know, what we are currently doing, and key information, key points to make. We've simplified it into one page, and this document that you're looking at has been provided to all of our administrators, who in turn met with their staffs at the sites and shared this information with the site employees. Mm-hmm. And with back to school nights coming, they will be providing the same talking points at the back to school evening presentations as well. In addition to that, we have an annual report that will be provided to the community that will go out following Labor Day. And in that report, I will provide much of the same information. So that will go out to over 30,000 residents in our general district area. And I just want you to know that we are taking this very seriously. We are analyzing it and developing a process as we move forward. If it's okay with you, I would like to share a story. And it's a narrative, if you will, of how we got to this place and why we're here tonight. And I think it's worthwhile that I read the story to the board. This is a public video, and I'd like it to be on record, as I think it sets the stage for future presentations to the board and to the public. A brief history of school finance in California. Until the early 1970s, school districts in California had extremely unequal levels of funding, largely because of varying levels of property taxes collected in their local communities. While primarily being funded from the state by per-pupil dollars, the different formulas of state funding in communities represented disparities of hundreds or thousands of dollars in per-pupil spending. A state Supreme Court case in 1972, known as Serrano versus Priest, changed that to a certain degree. Because the 14th Amendment guarantees equal protection under the law, it was successfully argued that this extreme disparity in funding was a violation of student access to equal protection. So the court ruling equalized funding a bit, but not entirely. At the end of that decade, another major change took place in the form of a ballot measure known as Proposition 13. This amendment to the California Constitution effectively capped the amount that annual property taxes could increase for businesses and homeowners. Of the 30-plus propositions on the ballot in 1978, most of which dealt with taxation, Proposition 13 was the most popular, receiving over 62% of voter approval. This taxpayer revolt was responsible for significant caps on runaway inflation in property taxes that disproportionately affected senior citizens on fixed incomes. Ronald Reagan on the national presidential stage and had a devastating outcome on local governments, public libraries, and especially public education in the state. Following Proposition 13, per pupil spending in California dropped over the years to a low of 48th in the nation, as the state has never been able to generate enough property taxes to fund schools at the pre-Prop 13 levels, adjusted for inflation. And it should be noted that I moved to California in 1979 as an eighth grader. And I heard all about it. Through many booms and busts since Prop 13, funding for California schools has increased and decreased dramatically. There was a time when so much money was flowing to districts that the state enacted and funded class size caps at the K-3 level. There were times when the funding dropped so significantly that many districts cut salaries and initiated furloughs for employees and students. The latest reform in school finance came in 2013 when Governor Brown and the state legislature passed a law to create the local control funding formula. Never has per pupil spending been as equalized across the state as with this measure. Effectively, all school districts receive the exact same level of funding per student, with some extra funds allocated for English learner students, those of a low socioeconomic background, and foster homeless youth. Virtually all special state funds, called categorical funds, that at one time were earmarked for pet programs and services, are now rolled into this single formula. Despite this, there is still a difference in state per pupil spending, and some school districts get more money than others. This has to do with areas where there is excess local property tax revenue. San Luis Coastal Unified School District is one of these areas. At the same time that so many changes occurred with school finance, one of the most powerful and controversial facilities in the state was built on our county shoreline. Pacific Gas and Electric Company broke ground for two pressurized water nuclear reactors in Avila Beach in 1968. Full completion did not happen until 1981. The first reactor went online in 1984 and the second in 1985. The delays were partially the result of typical federal and state mandates, but were also due to the concerns about two earthquake fault lines near the property. Significantly, one of the nation's largest ever protest efforts took place in opposition to the nuclear plant. Over a two-week period in 1981, nearly 2,000 people were arrested for protesting and blockading plant access. In the 30 years the plant has been operating, it serves at peak capacity about 9% of the entire state's electrical needs. But the controversy about the potential dangers of having nuclear reactors in our backyard has not waned. The tragedy in Fukushima and the efforts in groups like the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility have put the continued operation of the plant in jeopardy. Others, however, have prominently argued that Diablo does not emit greenhouse gases and is more environmentally sound for long-term energy needs than anything else on the immediate horizon. Whatever one's bias about nuclear power and reactors in Slo County, one thing has become clear. There's only one nuclear power plant left standing in the entire state, Diablo Canyon, and it will be closing down by 2025 at the latest. This announcement was made in June 2016. PG&E has made the decision unequivocally and will begin navigating terms of the closure with the California Public Utilities Commission, or CPUC. Those hearings will likely begin in January. As mentioned previously, there are some school districts for which all the rules of state funding do not apply. If a school district generates more local property tax revenue than would be received from a combination of local property taxes and other state funds, the district keeps the locally raised funds and does not receive a per pupil amount from the state. There are many names for this, like basic aid or excess tax or community funded districts. More often, these are elementary districts, usually with either very small student populations or very high home values, or a combination of the two. The number of basic aid districts varies from year to year, as some fall into and out of this status regularly. They serve about 3 to 4% of the state students. San Luis Coastal, as you know, is a basic aid school district. We have fairly high property values in the residential market, but like many coastal communities, we are not basic aid because of it. We receive 36% of the unitary taxes generated by PG&E by virtue of the nuclear power plant sitting in our backyard. This is coupled with other local property taxes, and this year has generated about $8 million in excess revenue that we would receive if we were state funded. This $8 million needs to be considered in its proper context. $8 million is the difference between $7,800 per child and $9,500 per child to educate. $8 million is the equivalent of 106 employee salaries from a workforce of just over 800. $8 million is the potential shuttering of schools, rising class sizes, cutting programs and services that we most have learned to love. $8 million represents a definite change in our circumstances. In fact, there are five things that we've identified that make San Luis Coastal unique with respect to the state-funded schools in our county. Number one, we pay extra attention to professional development and support of employees through curriculum and instructional initiatives. San Luis Coastal teachers have extensive in-services, substitute coverage, collaboration opportunities, and coaching to be the best and the most innovative. Number two, we have rich programs and services. Our district has counseling and mental health supports, reading intervention, preschools, parent education, technology, and specialized learning opportunities that are above and beyond our neighbors. Three, we have high salaries and excellent working conditions. All of our employee groups, classified, teaching, and administrative, have the highest salaries in the county. We enjoy the best health care packages and district contributions to health care in the county. We have the highest number of sick and personal leave days in the county. We have actively funded the retirement benefits promised to our staff. Four, we have small class sizes. It has been a continual commitment to keep class sizes low despite the contractual ability to raise them. We have the lowest in the county. 5. We have small schools. We have a district of about 7,400 students and run 15 schools. As an example, our average elementary school has 390 students, where the normal would might be closer to 600. When we lose the funds that are generated by Diablo Canyon, we'll have to look at all of those areas I just mentioned to seek and find our new normal. So what will happen between now and 2025 when Diablo Canyon closes the plant? This is a hard question to answer. What is certain is that there will approach and eventually fall off, we will fall off a budgetary cliff as ongoing resources dwindle. What PG&E has initially offered is to make us whole by contributing a sum of funds that could help us bridge that gap until 2025, and we appreciate that. What is also clear is that those dollars will not be in the form of property taxes. As a result, as the plant is depreciated, our share of property tax dollars will commensurately decrease. This scheduled depreciation begins right away. All of this points to our district becoming a state-funded district, we estimate, as early as 2020. We have filed to have a seat at the table in the negotiations that will take place at the CPUC. It is our aim to try to guarantee a level of funding that will last us the longest period of time, even if that funding does not keep us from being state funded. Any dollars that we receive can serve as a cushion to the hard landing we face as we fall off that cliff. But make no mistake, that cliff is there. Diablo is closing. We will no longer be community funded. We will lose $8 million in basic aid revenue. We also stand to lose an additional $3.8 million in categorical funds that we are still receiving as a result of being community funded. We are not entirely sure when our entire landscape changes, but we do know with certainty it will change. We will construct a 3-year reduction plan that will start in the 2017-2018 school year. We will ask the Board of Education to adopt that plan this January or February. It will undoubtedly involve the areas which were outlined above: programs, services, professional development, working conditions, class size, and school size. Prior to January, we will seek public input and we will share openly what it will take to align future revenues with expenditures. We expect there will not be a lot of choices in what is cut. We will look at other school districts around us and emulate them in their spending plans. We need to find our new normal. To the degree that we have extra reserves, which we have retained with the foresight that the board has exercised, coupled with any extra money we might receive in the PG&E deal at the PUC, this may help us to spread out the reductions a bit. For example, we believe it is far better to not replace an employee who retires than it is to lay off someone who we've recently hired. We believe it would be far better to slowly raise class sizes rather than radically change class sizes. We believe it is far better to change our landscape a bit more gradually, if at all possible. Anything we receive will not be ongoing revenue, but even one-time funds can help us migrate more carefully down to our new normal. We also know two other things. First, that our largesse over the years has enabled us to have the best and the brightest working for us, and it is our hope that we can keep these talented people. Secondly, we know that our community supports San Luis Coastal Schools, and we will be our will continue to be our partner in making sure that we remain a great school district. I'm not seeking action, but I'll field any questions you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Prater. Mr. Millar?
Dr. Prater, the funds that PG&E would end up providing to us in mitigation, it's been pointed out, are not going to be property tax monies. So how will that affect our schedule of entering revenue limit?
That's an excellent question and most pertinent. when PG&E came to meet with me, they shared an interest to keep us whole during the 8 years. What they failed to realize is how our funding model, our mechanism for maintaining community-funded status is maintained. So when I explained that to them, they provided me with a loose example of a depreciation schedule of how they plan to depreciate the two plants, Unit 1 and Unit 2. And what they realized is that as the property tax dollars depreciated, their $49.5 million commitment was to help us stay whole. What they didn't realize is that we would fall off irrespective of that commitment at some point as they depreciate that asset. So to answer your question, we expect that the they aren't going to entirely stop providing property tax through the unitary tax, but it will be on a depreciated schedule over the next 8 years. In our case, we expect, like I said, to fall out of basic aid status as early as 2020. And our negotiations with the PUC and with PG&E, hopefully we could find a way that that revenue, the depreciation schedule, could be delayed, potentially, so that we would stay in basic aid status throughout that 8-year period. Of course, enjoying, as a result of that, we would keep certain portions of our revenue locally. But no matter what, 2024, 2025, no matter what, we are going to be a state-funded school district, in my estimation.
It's hard for me to see, Mr. Unger.
Yeah, and just one thing I don't think we should gloss over is that any money that PG&E agrees to help make us whole is essentially one-time monies. Is that not correct?
That is exactly right. In fact, what I think is going to be difficult to understand in our community, which is why we're having this conversation publicly, is that that public perception that we will maintain our funding through 2025 is really a misnomer. It's really difficult to understand in the way schools are funded that we really need to make our reductions sooner, knowing that that's one-time money, so that the pool of resources we have on the other side of those reductions allows us to make strategic decisions about programs and priorities that we wouldn't otherwise have, because that one-time money will go fast, and the decisions will only get more difficult the longer we wait.
Okay, is there any additional board comment? Is there any public comment for this item? Sir.
My name is Will Jones. I'm a former employee of San Luis Coastal Unified School District. And I remember in the past that there was an additional kind of catastrophic element to this closing of the Diablo Canyon. And that was because we were a district that had a relatively small number by comparison to other districts of English learners and economically disadvantaged students, that in fact when we fell out of basic aid, that we would drop below the funding for most school districts who had higher numbers of those students. But it sounds as if because of the equalization in funding to districts throughout the state, that won't be the case. And to me, I think that might be an important bit of information to pass on to the public when the opportunity presents itself, because that was kind of terrifying for those of us who were thinking about the closure of Diablo Canyon and that additional revenue loss.
Thank you. Well, then, if there's no additional comment...
Could I just comment on yeah. what Mr. Jones was saying? I think one of the things, though, we need to realize is that there is a variability in school finance depending on the number of English language learners, kids in poverty, and foster students that are in a school district, which provides additional resources for them over a certain threshold, and we don't meet that threshold.
And Dr. Prater, is it anticipated that we would, over the next 8 to 10 years meet that threshold for concentration monies?
It's possible. It's conceivable. At this point, we have a 42% unduplicated count of students who qualify in those targeted areas. And that's a radical departure to what it was just 5 years ago. And so we are seeing students enrolling in our district at higher levels of need. And typically it's economic disadvantaged students that are struggling. However, we'd have to meet the 50% threshold to achieve some of the supplemental and concentration monies. And in terms of our EL and our foster youth, those numbers are much lower. They're 17% for our English learners. I believe that's our number. Our highest number is our students in poverty. And those are the students, that's the population with the most rapid growth in our district. We'll see what the trends look like in the years to come.
Thank you. I don't see any additional comments, so I'm going to move on to item 10.03. This is a proposed revision to Board Policy 0460, Philosophy, Goals, Objectives, Plans, the Local Control and Accountability.
Thank you.
Thank
you. We have a couple of board policies that these are recommended changes by the California School Board Association. They're kind of minor changes, and I can actually only guess on the reasons for a couple of them. I'll try to outline, but it's purely conjecture on my part, actually. The first one has to do with the LCAP. We last updated this policy a couple years ago, but as we all know, the LCAP is a rapidly evolving document and planning document, and really the changes have to do with the fact that now it's codified in the California Code of Regulations, but also you'll notice at the in the first page is a cross out saying, in addition, the LCAP shall address any local priorities adopted by the board. My guess is that because, as we illustrated just a few minutes ago, the board adopts all kinds of priorities, such as what we're going to do about nuclear plant closures or Measure D facility funding, that really don't have a lot to do with the LCAP and probably wouldn't be appropriate to try to incorporate into the LCAP. I'm guessing that's why CSBA recommended crossing that out. It's not that we couldn't have other priorities in the LCAP. So that's my guess on that one. And on the second page, if you scroll down, please, Mrs. Holmes, there's also, it was crossed out, a cross out in addition in terms of the outreach. The cross out was the board may also consult with community organizations, stakeholders, and interest groups in developing the LCAP. And the addition had to do with student outreach specifically, which was really highlighted last year. Again, my guess has to do with the fact that the real focus in education code is that you reach out to your employee groups, your parents, your teachers, your principals, your bargaining units. You reach out to your parents specifically, parents that have to be included, which are the advisory committee made up of your socioeconomically disadvantaged foster homeless youth and your district English language advisory, and now a real strong focus on getting student input, whereas the opportunity for other stakeholders is really after the LCAP is developed and it's made public and you're presenting it formally in board meetings. That's my conjecture about that. But these are CSBA recommendations, and they're certainly up for your review and questions.
Mr. Buckman.
Rick, I'm sorry you have to deal with all these codes and board policies. I'm sure you get lots of good sleep.
Yes.
So as I'm looking at the first proposed change on page A, the second paragraph, where you're talking about the inclusion of the California Code of Regulations, I'm very confused as to why we would be that specific, and I'm not sure we can't. I have no idea why they would do this. But if we're going to mention that, would it be helpful to people that are reading this board policy to sort of explain at least spell out what CCR is, because it's not one of the common ones, and I'm just not sure why they're making it this complicated, because is using a template provided by the state. But anyway, my suggestion is to just sort of at least spell out what CCR is, so parents have a chance of finding it.
Okay, then was your light on, Mr. Questenberry, earlier?
My light's always on, but not at this particular place
in time. Okay, then we'll have Mr. Millar, and then followed by Mr. Unger.
Well, I was just going to see if there's consensus to act on this tonight, but it sounds like there's a change that's been proposed. So.
And I'd like to refer to page B, the strikeout. I'm actually not comfortable with the strikeout. I think the sense is, for me, the board may consult. And I'd like to leave us, as a board policy, the opportunity to be able to direct the administration to consult with these other stakeholder groups. And I think this is going to be, as we go through the process of engagement in our community because of the loss of Diablo Canyon and the loss of our revenues, I think the more we can engage our community, if we want to, is going to be sending a message to the community that we're all in this together. So I'm actually not in favor of taking out this may consult with these other groups. Well, no, it says shall consult with, and then it leaves that, and then there's the strikeout, may consult with other community organizations, stakeholders, and interest groups. So,
do you have suggested language, Mr. Unger?
My suggested language is not to take it out. It's not to strike it.
Okay. What's the Mrs. Sheffer?
If we leave that in, Mr. Unger, my suggestion would be to put it after the new sentence, because I do think our students and staff and groups should come before the community organizations, stakeholders, and interest groups.
I just said I don't have a problem with that.
Okay. Then, Mr. Robinette, what is the board's feeling on the changes that have been suggested here?
Well, could we approve tonight with the, same with the changes suggested?
Either way, it's not time sensitive. If you want, if I'm understanding it, would the board's direction be to spell out the code language there in some clearer way, to put back the sentence that is on strikeout on page 2 and replace it after the new underlined sentence, and I can certainly bring that back for a second reading, or just do it, whatever you prefer.
Well, Mrs. Sheffer?
Well, I would just suggest that if perhaps Mr. Millar wants to make his motion with that we could see if we don't have to bring it back.
I don't want to do that anymore. I want to bring it back.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
But I'm on
one. Well, I think that there's been expressed, at least by one board member, a preference to have this returned to us at the next board meeting with the modifications that were suggested.
And those are the modifications the board wants to see.
As I understand it.
Okay.
Okay. So then, the next item, 10.04, is again a proposed revision to board policy, this time board policy 0500, philosophy, goals, objectives, plans, and accountability, a first reading.
Okay, this is closely related. It has to do with accountability, and this is found in the first section of the board policies, which has to do with specific board actions. So this has to do with accountability measures. Again, just cleanup language. This is all recommended from CSBA. If you scroll up to page A, Mrs. Holmes, Basically, we have a lot of added language that has to do with both state and federal accountability and the fact that accountability now is based on the LCAP. So I think that would summarize what those paragraphs are, that we have to be accountable to the state, to the feds, and to our local control accountability plan. And it's interesting in that there's language in here that talks about adequate yearly progress, which is still the federal requirement, and also language that talks about the academic performance index, which is being held in abeyance right now. There is no such thing as an API. It's going to be called API, I am certain we will have something like that. We will have a score of some sort that we will be measured on year by year at the state level. But that's what's currently in Ed Code. It's currently on the, if you go to the CDE website, it talks about API. There's just no such thing as it right now, but that's what that refers to. And then on page B, there's a kind of a significant strikeout where it says opportunities for feedback from students, parents, staff, and community members shall be made available as part of the district's review and evaluation process. The reason for this strikeout, according to the CSBA advisory, is because this is in the policy you just approved. It's the opportunities for feedback and review are the local control accountability plan, which is the policy you just approved. So unnecessary to have it in this section. Those are the recommended changes.
Okay. Mr. Buckman, followed by Mr. Millar.
Thank you very much. Rick and I have had some communication on this. One of the other interesting things that's still in here is a reference to the high school exit exam, which is also on hold, and we don't know how that's coming back. So, but my question really goes to, in not all board policies or not all districts adopt all the recommended policies, but in this board policy, there are references to two policies. So after the initial addition of indicators of district programs progress, it refers to two ed codes, two board policies that we have not had a chance to adopt yet. And I just at this point would sort of like to recommend that we just take those out until the board or until staff has time to bring forward those board policies and see if we're interested in doing it. But I'd hate to see somebody looking at this board policy and then going and looking for the referenced board policies and not finding them. Then on the third,
Mr. Buckman's referring unto sure. The, I think the Latin term is confere, is that right? Confer, CF, is a reference, is a reference 6162.5. We don't have a policy specific to that. I don't believe we don't. And right. Also the state academic achievement test policy, which is right below that, is probably outdated. It refers to STAR testing. It's a one right. paragraph policy, but it does mention STAR testing. So those are probably not necessarily relevant for us.
So my recommendation is to just delete those two until we have a chance to work on those.
Mr. Millar.
Why are we adopting a policy that makes reference to non-existent things?
Yeah,
I mean, that's kind of the fundamental question.
Yeah, it's probably an oversight on my part. These are just
well, no, it's not. If the reference is to the API and there is no current API, and then a reference to the CASI, and we're not doing the CASI, it seems like. I mean, I guess I know why. Well, actually, I don't know why we're doing this.
I think the policy was put forward by CSBA to make sure that accountability is not just a local thing, that it has to do with state guidelines, federal guidelines, and LCAP guidelines, which did not exist in this policy before.
And if I can back up Rick's statement, I went back and looked at code, and both API and the high school exit exam are still on the books. And so they still exist, unfortunately, in law.
Mrs. Sheffer.
So I would suggest that we perhaps consider just not acting on this at this time. There are references to things that don't exist or may change. It seems that perhaps at a later time you'd be coming back to us and saying, now we're revising it, or CSBA is suggesting that we revise this to omitting CASI or replacing it with whatever the newest thing is, or changing API, or it just seems that we don't, perhaps in action at this time, not doing anything, is not certainly not going to create any harm, and may make things easier on down the road. So that's my suggestion.
Mr. Questenberry.
I concur with Mrs. Sheffer's evaluation of this or assessment of it, and I think this could be delayed or put off to another time.
Yeah, and unless there's a time critical element to this, I would absolutely support the notion of just letting sleeping dogs lie and bringing it back later.
Okay, so it sounds to me, and I agree, so a majority of the board is indicating they would like to just hold this board policy and any amendments to it in abeyance, indefinite abeyance.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Okay. So item 10.05 is Measure D, Bid 268, approve the notice of completion for C.L. Smith campus-wide stucco painting and Teach Elementary exterior painting. Mr. Palazzo.
Yes, well, as an architect, it's usually the more exciting time to get the project, start the project, design the project. But I'm a little different. I like to finish the project. So we have now finished our first round of Measure D projects in their entirety. Basically, contractually, what we're required to do, and I'll just describe this real briefly, and then this will apply to all the projects that you'll be seeing now and kind of on into the future. Contractually, when a contractor is hired through the bid process, they have subcontractors. And those subcontractors will file what they call preliminary notices with the County of San Luis Obispo. That lets us know that those subcontractors have a contract on the project. And in the private world, they would have lien rights. But because we're a public agency, they don't have lien rights. They only have stop payment notice rights. So that's their ability, if a contractor does not pay them, to notify the district and work out a deal so that they get paid directly and money doesn't go necessarily to the contractor. I'll try to keep this simple and short. So that preliminary notice goes in before they start working on the project. They start working on the project. We make progress payments throughout the project to the contractor. Subsequently, that contractor pays their subcontractors. As the project wraps up, we are still holding a portion of the money, which we call retention, to make sure that they get everything done, they give us all the manuals, all the scratches, dings, dents, etc., are all resolved. And then we hold that money also to flush out any of the stop notices that may come in if a subcontractor was not paid during the project. So what this action does is it basically, the board adopts the project as complete. It doesn't mean every single thing is done. It means the project is substantially complete. There may be a few little punch list items or some minor things that we'll work out with the contractor, but we're able to use the project. It's complete. The work is all in place. It's all functioning, etc. That will then, we'll file the notice with the county that we are notice what they call the notice of completion. That goes to the county. All of the subcontractors that supplied a preliminary notice to the county will then be notified that the district is getting ready in 45 days to make the final payment to the contractor. And if any of them have a payment issue with the contractor, they then can notice us and we can then work out that issue with that subcontractor directly. So this action that the board's taking tonight has been reviewed by the architect and/or engineer on the project, has been reviewed by the inspector, been reviewed by our staff, and the project is ready for board action for completion. This week we'll file notice of completions with the county, and that will start the clock ticking on release of retention in roughly 45 days, plus a little bit more from the day we file the notice, to the contractors that are due that final retention monies. So Any questions? We're seeking approval on the three notices on the board agenda tonight.
So Mrs. Sheffer, followed by Mr. Millar.
So a quick question. This, mm-hmm. this would be our to understand the process on down the line. When you say there may be a few other punch list items, so does that mean there may be additional things that cost money?
No. There would be a scratch in a door, or a piece of hardware might be missing. The cover on that door closer might be missing, and it's on order, and it's just not coming. We're not going to hold up $1 million or, you know, $50,000 over a $100 cover.
Okay. So when we say an item that something is complete, mm-hmm. a notice of completion, when we approve that, we're approving that from a budgetary standpoint, it's complete as well. I mean, my question is,
yeah.
are we done paying money now? I understand that there may be a scratch on the door or, mm-hmm. you know, something. And by the way, C.L. Smith looks great. But are we saying that is now we will not be paying any more
money? So is there any change orders coming down the line?
No additional costs.
Yeah, no additional costs.
So to clarify that, there might be some additional costs that have already been approved but haven't come to the board yet. So at the next board meeting, you might see some change orders that kind of trickle in after. But those have already been working on. They're finishing up the paperwork on those. We're tightening up the numbers. So no, not necessarily the formal board action on that change order may not have been taken by then. But we've got it all worked out with the contractor at this point on these specific projects.
Okay, so whatever we've spent for C.L. Smith under this notice of completion.
There's one small change order coming at the next board meeting.
Is all that we'll be spending.
I think it's tonight.
C.L. Smith has one tonight. He has about 4,000.
Or 10.08.
Okay. I think I understand.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Millar.
To put it another way, so when you bring a notice of completion forward to the board and recommend approval, you are representing to the board that the project is substantially complete.
Correct.
Okay. And as long as we've figured out when we bid to paint both sides of the door, then I'm
good.
So
funny story. We got a request today to paint chalkboard paint on the inside of all the doors we had just painted. So
great idea.
So it's not always that intuitive whether we should or should not paint the inside of doors.
Mr. Buckman.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Anthony, if it would help. I know it would help me. So you're talking about a dollar door knocker or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, I get that. But in my mind, it would be beneficial to maybe have a not to exceed in this agreement, so that staff would have some way. So if it's, you know, at what point do we say it's okay to complete the punch list and but not have everything quite there yet?
Well, so at this point, let's just say this project is, I'm going to use round numbers, it's
sure.
$500,000, $500,000. We're keeping 5% of that money. Contractor has submitted a payment to he wants or she wants the $500,000. They're done with the work. They submit that. We're withholding 5%. So we still have $25,000 of the $500,000. So we withhold that when they submit their final payment, the $25,000, the 5% of it. And then any of the little stuff that's maybe not resolved, or there's some warranty items, or there's, you know, a few little minor things, that's if they don't act on that or don't resolve those issues between now and the time of retention, we withhold a portion of that and then resolve it and then pay them the balance. Or if there's a subcontractor that was owed $5,000 and we determine that, yeah, they truly are, and the contractor says, yeah, I didn't pay him, you know, so then you pay him and then you take the $5,000 out of the retention. So that's what we're doing with this action.
So when we're looking at approving a notice of completion, actually we've got back whatever percent.
We've got the 5%.
We've got some money in our pocket.
Correct.
Okay.
What this does is it starts the clock ticking on when we can release that money.
Mr. Unger.
I'm just thinking, unless there's public comment, I would move approval of item 10.05.
Okay, and I just had a question. So if I can be clear on this, it's we are approving not the release of retentions, but that the final progress billing has been made and the work is complete. And so we're still holding, like if you're putting in the carpet, person comes in and they bang up the walls, laying the carpet and putting the base or whatever, the painter has to come back and touch up those walls. That's part of his work. And so he would do that as part of punch list work. If it isn't done in a length of time, then we can cause the work to be done by others and be paid out of his retention.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. I get it.
Now, on these projects, we're down to the three little things. I mean, this is just minor. They're waiting for something to come in. It's an order. It's on order. You know, it's all small stuff at this point.
We're just trying, I think, as a board, or maybe I should speak for myself, but I'm trying to understand it because it will be happening over and over again as we go forward with Measure D. So hopefully if we can get all, I can get my questions and maybe other board members can get their questions asked and answered on this first go-around, we won't have to go through this repeatedly. So we have a motion then by Mr. Unger and a second by Mr. Millar. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to speak to this? Seeing no one then, those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes 6-0 with one absent. And then don't move, Mr.
Oh, I'm here for a while.
So, item 10.6, Measure D, bid 269, approved notice of completion for the Del Mar Elementary water line and Mora Elementary sewer line installations.
Now, this is a project that is complete, substantially complete. We do have some change order items and some extra work, et cetera, that we're still working through with the contractor, but the work is complete. We are able to, you know, start the clock ticking on release of the actual contract work that has been completed and in place to date. We still do have some change order items that we'll be working with the contractor the next week, and we'll bring that to you at a future date.
Okay. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to speak to this item? In fact, I'd like to note that there is no one now present from the general public, so I'll cease going to the public, but if any member of the public should re-enter the room, I'll then go back to calling for their comment. Is there anyone from the board who wishes to speak to this item? Mrs. Sheffer.
I would move approval of notice of completion for Del Mar Elementary water line and the Morrow Elementary sewer line.
I'll second.
The motion by Mr. Millar, second by Mrs. Sheffer. All in favor?
I just want to say the people at Del Mar are thrilled about having the water.
Clean, clear water. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes 6-0 with one absent.
Nothing clears the room like notice of completions, let me tell you.
Item 10.06, Measure D, bid 269. Approved notice of completion for the Del Mar Elementary water line. I just did that one. I beg your pardon. 10.07. Measure D, bid 270. Approved notice of completion for the Sunnyside Elementary and Teach Elementary paving and slurry seal. Mr. Palazzo.
We're done.
Okay. Mr. Questenberry.
I just want to say how nice that looks now. It's wonderful. I only had one negative comment from someone. They didn't like the slope of the basketball court. But I went out there and I found that it made a lot of sense to be sloped the way it is. So anyway.
If we don't slope asphalt, it gets bird baths, and then it fails.
It looks great. So,
were you slam dunking like crazy?
Well, I don't do that much anymore, but you know, it is. Anyway, I move approval of the item 10.07.
And I'll second that, please.
So I have a motion by Mr. Questenberry, second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
I know.
That passes 6-0 with one absence.
Well, we could have done that under this next
Okay. Item 10.8, Measure D, ratification of change orders.
Okay, I'm getting the hook here. So.
Yeah, no, you're going to explain them. So I just wanted to open up, in terms of the summer work, again, this is kind of my first summer as CBO in the midst of construction projects and moving forward. And so the key for me is just when you're – I think with these projects in particular that you're going to see tonight and as we go through the summer projects, and again, we're going to bring back kind of any and all, talk about each of the summer projects at the next board study session as well as any and all change orders and processes. So these are the change orders tonight that I've actually been gone through with both Mr. Holcomb, with Mr. Palazzo, with Steve Stewart, or Rick Stimson, with the contractors, with the architects, with all involved, and have been kind of completed through that official process, and again, we will be kind of explaining the intricacies of that change order process at our next board study session. So without any further ado, I'm going to have Mr. Plaza walk the board through what each of these changes were, why they happened, and the reason why these are in front of you tonight.
Okay. This is high excitement stuff, guys. This is pressure-reducing valves at Del Mar. So one of the basic things is when you have water coming in from the city, it's usually at a very high pressure. On the site at Del Mar, we had reviewed the site, looked all around, could not find a pressure-reducing valve. So we had to kind of work under the assumption that there wasn't one on the site. Well, we found one as we started to excavate the lines buried underneath a tree, which is completely not atypical, if you will. You need to have access to it. You need to be able to service the valve, etc. So when we found it, we discovered that, yes, indeed, there is the city's water service is over code required 90 PSI, so we had to install this valve. But what also came along with it is the valve, the box, the 4 to 5 foot round hole to get all that equipment put in there, because it's a fairly large piece of equipment. And so this cost represents the extra dollar amount, if you will, required to put that new valve in and all the work, labor, etc. associated with it. As we've talked about, the any questions on that? Sorry. Keep moving. At Teach and C.L. Smith, the painting project, we opted in the plans not to have painting the inside of the doors. When we got out there, we kind of looked at them. Yeah, it's not going to look quite right. Let's go ahead and paint the doors. $100 a door was a really good price that the contractor gave us to do that. You know, with all the prep and the taping and the masking and everything to paint the inside of the doors, we came on a really good price for that. So that's what, and there is 140 some doors out there, hence the $14,000 for that project. At the temp housing project for temp housing at Slow High and the CL Smith, we ran into, surprise, surprise, some bad soil at Slow High. And so that soil had to be pulled out, and we had to put in new base material underneath the kitchen and the restroom project.
When you say bad, what do you mean by that?
So it was really rocky. So typically when you have soil and you're going to, for relocatables, you dig it up. It's soft soil. You pull it out of the hole. You mush it around. You stick it back in the hole, and you pound the...
Compact it.
You compact it. Thank you. I was trying to use, not technical terms, but you basically over-ex and recompact it, as we call it, over-excavate and recompact it, to get a density of the soil so that the building minimizes any building settlement that you have with it. When we got into that soil, it was really rocky. In other words, it wouldn't crumble up and it wouldn't compact, and we couldn't get it the compaction that we needed to have that building be stable. So we pulled all that soil out, put in new road-based material, basically, about 12 inches of it, and that gives us a nice stable bottom to put the building down on. And that was at both those, the restroom and the kitchen building.
Are they adjacent to one another?
Yes. Yeah.
So would there be any reasonable expectation that we will find that soil elsewhere on the site and
in that
and
specific
have to remove
area,
it?
We didn't. So with relocatables, we don't do soils testing. At the other building projects, the new ones going in, we are doing soils testing, so we know the soil profile there. So we'll and those typically have what they call an over-ex and recompact. And most of the time, anecdotally at San Luis Obispo specifically, we do an import of soil. So we take all the soil out and put in all new soil just because it is so bad.
Okay.
And usually
thank
at
you.
About 5 feet in depth.
The other thing was, is the architect said, you know, rightfully so, put some wood chips in the plans to have the contractor in some of the planter areas around these buildings. And we said, hey, we got piles of chips in our yard. We'll have our team go ahead and do that, give us the credit back. So that was the other item there. Then at the tennis courts, there's a couple things. One is at the Morro Bay High School site, we encountered a bunch of electrical boxes. We knew they were there. We had hoped to be able to reuse them. When we kind of excavated them and got them out, they were all broken. They were cracked. They weren't in good shape. So we opted to basically pull all those out and replace them with new ones instead of trying to reuse the existing. It was the right thing to do. We also upgraded them to a traffic-rated box, where some of them weren't traffic-rated, because even if it's not an area we normally drive on, every so often either the public or one of our guys will need to drive up on a sidewalk or drive somewhere. And if they happen to hit one, it's just nice to have it be traffic-rated so that we don't have to be replacing lids or have trucks breaking through our boxes. And that happened at two different instances. We found the first batch at one point early in the summer, and then we found another couple of electrical, larger electrical vault boxes in that second item in that change order later on in the summer. So that's why it's kind of two separate items within the same change order. The other item you'll see, and you're going to see more coming on this specific item, is the soil stabilization. As you all know, there is the gas line that runs through that western corner, if you will, of San Luis Obispo High School. The tennis courts are over that. So in working around that line, it was determined in the field that we should put, instead of digging all the soil up in the same capacity where we talked about, digging it up, compacting it, not trying to not disturb that gas line at all, we were able to dig down and then put this soil stabilization fabric over it, and then we build up on top of it. And that gives us a little bit of cushion that can stay underneath or on top of that gas line so that we're not disturbing it, not vibrating on it, not, you know, heavy rolling over it and potentially damaging it or causing a leak or something. So we did that all in conjunction with the gas company. That's the purchase of the material. Since this change order was written, they have now installed the base above it, et cetera, so there'll be a future change order on that item coming for that specific item. And I think that was all the items at the tennis courts at this time in that change order number one. So that is a short, abbreviated history of the first round of change orders that we saw through the summer. We've got some more we're working on that we're tightening up the numbers with the contractors, and we'll be bringing those back very shortly at the next board meeting, hopefully.
Mr. Palazzo, could
yes.
you just explain, I see where the vaults, the boxes, and the fabric are all materials only, or could be materials only at one point and then labor in a subsequent change order, but additional square footage of sidewalk and curb.
Yes, thank you. I forgot about that part of it. So if you're looking at the Morro Bay High School tennis courts, staying from the school side looking at them, over on the east end of them is the Ag Barn. And we had called out a small 5 or 6 foot wide sidewalk where the ag pens had kind of bumped out and then went back in. I'm doing talkitecture, I apologize. But basically, when we got out there and we started working on it, it really made sense to let's move the ag pens, move those over, line everything up along with the edge of the barn that's out there, and just give it a nice 10, 12-foot wide walkway all the way down around the tennis courts, and it really cleaned that area up nicely. So this was an extra, you know, we had called out about 5 feet down the side of the tennis courts. This expanded that to about 12 feet.
So this would be an example of a field condition
yes.
change.
Well,
where you take a look at it and you say, hey, it'd be improved if we
there.
Did this. Mm-hmm. And so it's a change that we, the district,
mm-hmm. yeah.
decided that we would like
yeah.
to have.
Same thing with those boxes. Those are the same thing. We got out there, I don't want to leave those boxes in the ground. We pull them. You know, you can't open every single box. You can't see all the damage to every single box as you're looking at it even. And so, you know, it's that balance between trying to save money up front, but then also, you know, not do things half-heartedly. It's not the word I'm thinking of, but, you know, do them
okay.
correctly the first time.
Is there any board comment on this item? Seeing none, I'll move approval then.
I'll second it.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 6-0 with one absent. Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Palazzo. Okay,
that's
we're
all
moving on to the action consent.
What's that?
So you're the only one left out there.
Oh, wow.
You are the sole public
it's
comment.
It's not the first time, won't be the last.
Okay, I'm going to read off the items on action consent. Please let me know if you'd like anything to be pulled. Item 11.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items.
Pull.
And who did that? Was Mr.
Questenberry?
11.02, equipment of furniture and equipment requests. 11.03, approval of purchase orders and CalCard expenditures. 11.04, approval of warrants and payroll. 11.05, disposition of surplus property. 11.06, acceptance of donations. 11.07, approval of quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, the Williams settlement. So I am looking for a motion to approve 11.02 through 11.07.
I move approval of 11.02 to 11.07.
Okay, so I have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 6-0 with one absent. And Mr. Quesenberry, item 1.
I just wanted to note that we have two retirements, and I want to commend Maureen McGee and Rose Fowler for their service to the district. I know Rose personally. I've had the opportunity to work with her through SLCTA and then know of her work at the various elementaries as a elementary counselor, and she's was a wonderful advocate for our students and a wonderful advocate for our profession. And having said that, I move approval of item 11.01. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Unger, did you wish to speak to that item as well?
I just wanted to add my thanks to Mr. Quesenberry's thanks to these folks. They were tremendous employees and really added a lot to the district, and they will be missed.
Would you like to second his motion?
I will second that motion.
Okay, so we have a motion by Mr. Quesenberry, second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 6-0 with one absent. Is there anyone who has anything for the advance agenda?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman.
Thanks. We had talked about this earlier, and I was wondering if staff is ready to come forward with a California High School, CHKS, California Healthy Kids. I don't know if that report's public yet.
I'm sorry, we can't understand you down at this end, Mr. Buckman.
Okay.
You can direct it toward the board. So
well, I thought if I directed it towards the microphone, it would reverberate through the building. So
sorry.
I'm so sorry. Yeah. I just wondered whether the results of the Healthy Kids survey was available yet. It's being used more and more in the state, and I was hoping that we could see that if it was available.
Okay, and the administrative response was?
We do already have a plan to agendize it, but not for, it's in October when we have it mostly laid out for October at this point.
Is that satisfactory to you, Mr. Buckman?
Yeah, that'll be great.
To wait that long? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, then, if that was the only...
No.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Quesenberry.
Yeah, as we face the loss of revenue from the pending closure of Diablo Canyon, I would like for us to take a very close look at our options with regard to the students that are coming to us by way of Cayucas Elementary District and the implications for us and for Coast Unified School District. And I'm looking for someone to perhaps support that.
And I'll support that.
Okay. When you ask for a close look, I'm not sure exactly. Did you want
where we stand to date and what possible recourses we have if there is nothing done in the next year or so.
So did you want that in the form of an agenda item or Friday notes?
I'm looking for some help on this from the administration. Do they think it would be best and tactful and politic to do it as something in our notes, or is it something that we can agendize?
We could do both. It's been a while since we've discussed this, but there's been a lot of movement under the waterline, so to speak, administratively. There's been a report that's been completed, funded by the Cayuga School Board, and it was just recently provided to the school board. I have not seen it. It's confidential at this point, but I know that a report was given, and so I can provide. I could provide initially some, give the board an update in Friday notes as to share what I know at this point, and then if you would like to see this move to a more formal agenda item, that would be something we could discuss at PLRC, because it is something we are talking about.
So if at the time that we had that PLRC discussion, Mr. Questenberry could join us perhaps at PLRC,
yeah,
since this was his item. So, Jim, does that work for
that,
you?
The Friday notes and then my attendance at a PLRC meeting would be acceptable to me. So
okay.
It doesn't have to be agendized at this time.
Okay, great. And then no other advance agenda items. And I am realizing now, and I apologize, that as we went through all of those Measure D items, I neglected to go to Mr. Holcomb for any input that he would like to give to the board. I realize it's after the fact, but you've stuck with us the whole evening. Is there anything you would like to add? In the future, I promise to remember to go to you because you are our representative.
We did have a couple folks asking me up or down.
Eloquent thumbs up.
You're working the hand signals. Okay.
See, I thought he was here just for, you know, to make us look better as a whole group.
And he does.
He does, but.
Okay, well, in that case, I believe that we are ready to adjourn, and we will next. I beg your pardon.
Board reports.
You can leave. Okay, let's see. Mr. Buckman, followed by Mr. Questenberry.
Sure. Thank you. I went and visited Morro Bay High School and St. Louis High School construction sites with Ron, and it was quite impressive. I happened to get there when some huge machine looked more like a Tyrannosaurus Rex, lifted up an entire wall of the annex building and threw it someplace. And then what I found most interesting on that visit was we parked in front of a post in a fence, stone fence, and on it is a plaque that said, built by the WPA in 1939.
Uh-huh.
So I was totally impressed with that. I attended the new teacher barbecue. We got a great group of new folks coming on board, and they are really excited about working in the district. And I will be sending out the dates and the speakers for the Tri-County Education Coalition over the year. Our October 7th, for example, we will have Ron Bennett or John Gray from School Services. So these will be a series of meetings that are attended by folks from Ventura, Santa Barbara, and San Luis Obispo County. And we usually have really great participation because of the level of the speakers. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Unger.
Well, it's been a busy summer. One thing that we're doing at CSBA is we've started a charter school task force, which is, I think, really critical considering what's going on. I'll make it quick. Considering what's going on with charter schools in California nationwide, and we've taken we have the belief that charter schools are here to stay. What can we do? And I actually had the honor of testifying in front of the State Education Committee on charter schools, which was quite an experience. We had our CSBA Summer Leadership Institute. Great speakers, Peter Senge, Pedro Noguera, and Linda Darling-Hammond. One of the interesting sessions I went to was on school construction. It was actually a several-part one. But what I realized is how far ahead we are in our school construction plans. and having Mr. Holcomb available to be our representative could be such a lesson to every other school district in California that's trying to do this. And then I was just in Chicago last week for an NSBA event, and that was pretty interesting too.
Mr. Questmere.
I just want to make a comment on the charter school part that CSBA is playing. There's a very interesting article in the New Times about the lack of diversity at two charter schools in our county, and I've had it confirms the suspicion I've had about many charter schools. So anyway, just thought I'd add that thing.
So, and I would just invite anybody that is not offended by foul language to go to YouTube and look at John Oliver's study on charter schools that just was a couple of days ago.
And the language isn't that bad.
The language was pretty bad.
Very, very cogent.
I'm not offended by foul language, as many of you know, but my comment would be that on back to school nights, I noticed that we have a number of schools that are having their back to school nights at the exact same time on the same day, and I know that they don't structure those for the benefit of board members. It does make it a little difficult for us to get around. We have to sort of pick a school. I think it might make it a little difficult for parents who have kids at a middle school, high school, and elementary, or is that taken care of?
We do not schedule middle schools, elementaries, and high schools on the same night. We try carefully to avoid that. But
okay.
We do have, for example, three elementary schools without one
and
that feeds into Pacheco or Teach on the same night. So the principals try to be really careful in a short window to get their back-to-school nights, but not to force parents of a same family to have to divide and conquer.
So they have accommodated those who are really important in the back to school nights, and for board members,
we just
have to get our chaps and spurs on and go as fast as we can. Okay, this meeting is now adjourned. We will meet again on September 6th for a Measure D study session. Thank you.
While I have you here, just on that September 16th Measure D study session, we're going to meet down here because we have negotiations using the B3 conference room.